This is Bob Fetrakis with The Other Side of the News, brought to you by thefreepress.org. WCRS Community Radio 98.3 and 102.1.
This is Bob Fetrakis with The Other Side of the News. I'm in the studios here at WCRS with Lawrence Richards, who's been interning with the Free Press and writing many articles. He'll be reporting from across the pond when he goes back, helping to establish the freepress.org's bureau in England. Lawrence.
Hello.
How's it going?
It's going all right, thank you.
Well, as the editor of the Free Press, I was very impressed with your reporting you did in a short period of time. Why don't you tell the listeners of WCRS-FM a little about your major stories, which they can find at freepress.org. That's freepress.org. One of the first major ones you wrote had to deal with the question of Russia and, of course, Mr. Snowden, the whistleblower.
Yes.
And possible issues with energy.
Right. So Russia, the situation with Russia was particularly interesting. They had Edward Snowden, and as we know from a long and distinguished history of Russia causing trouble for the United States and the West in general, that they don't hand people over. So it was a good thing for Snowden that he was able to escape to that position. However, President Putin then said while he was there, "We will give you asylum, but only if you stop talking. You need to stop releasing this information." And that seemed very strange to us. So I ended up doing some research for a piece about that, looking at what interests Putin might have had to try and shut Snowden up. It seemed a bit strange that someone who would otherwise want to humiliate the United States in this situation didn't want that to happen. So if you look into some of the figures, you look at the financial interests, that's really where the secret to that lies. The fact that, for instance, 65% of Russian exports are from the energy sector, the Russian energy sector, going into Europe.
And every now and then that gets into the news, like when he would cut off like energy to Ukraine. Or
that was a huge situation. And I think 2009, there was a big argument about a pipeline with Ukraine, yes. So although Russia's not formally part of the European Union, they have a large number of interactions with it, particularly financial and occasionally political.
And what was your theory here? Why would Putin care with all that energy? What happens with the West? Couldn't he just export it elsewhere?
So Snowden's last big releases were that the USA was spying on Brussels, the heart of the European Union, and also on several leading member states, including Germany, the UK, and France.
Why wouldn't Russia want that to go forward? It would clearly create tension between the US and its key allies.
It would create tension between the US and the key allies. This seems to me as something like a dilemma for the Russians. Because on the one hand, they would like to kind of sow discord, but on the other hand, the only reason that Putin has as much power as he does is not because he's super good at judo. It's rather more because he's got financial interests that back him. These interests would suffer if the European Union would break up, and this is something that I wanted to explore particularly in the article, was that There are two main tensions with the European Union as it stands at the moment. One of which is a question of sovereignty, which is being seriously hammered by the European Union, which is, for all intents and purposes, huge and undemocratic. And the other side of it was economic, and the fact that the Eurozone has been suffering terribly for the last 5 years, with unemployment in some countries, youth unemployment in Greece, for instance, going up to currently 60%. So there's a large threat that the European Union could break up. If that happens, many of these Russian interests, some of which are directly linked to the Russian state, would immediately lose customers and would immediately affect the Russian economy.
Well, is the trade deals with Russia with the European Union, or is it with the individual sovereign states?
There are a variety of different deals. Sometimes it's with the European Union itself. For instance, there are several different pipelines going through to Russia's region of Kaliningrad, which actually neighbours Poland and Lithuania. And they need to kind of make sure that that has access to European
countries
markets.
That are part of NATO now.
Yes, that's true. So things have changed somewhat. But yes, Europe as an entity, even though Russia does not do all of its news, all of its trade directly with the entire European Union, because it's not yet a super state. If member states were to separate, millions of jobs would immediately disappear. For instance, in the UK, there are 3 million jobs that would vanish overnight if we were to leave the European Union.
What is the UK's relationship with the European Union? Are they a full member?
The UK is a full member, except for two main differences. One is Schengen, which is the agreement made in the 2000s for freedom of passage throughout all the different regions. The UK not just being an island, but also being somewhat misanthropic and distrustful of their friends on the continent, their counterparts on the continent, I should say. And the other side of it was, hang on, I just said Schengen. What was the other one?
Currency.
Currency, yeah, that big one. Yes, because the pound is sacred, the pound must be protected. And actually, the pound is currently a much stronger currency than the euro, so that was actually a good call. There's also now a political situation where now more than half of Brits don't want to be part of the European Union at all, and there is a big demand for a referendum.
And the European Union itself, you said it was undemocratic, but doesn't it have an elected parliament compared to the United States, North American Treaty Organization that has three appointed bureaucrats? How does that whole European parliament work?
So that is a fig leaf of democracy to cover the nakedness of absolutism, basically.
And where does the absolutism come from? Say Germany.
Germany has huge control because they have financial interests in several different countries, and that particularly in Greece, for instance, which is how they've been able to control Greek economic policy enormously. As for the European democracy itself, there's a kind of veneer of it where we get to vote every 5 years on members of the European Parliament, but the powers of the European Parliament are restricted purely to voting on legislation which they themselves do not write. So they have very little real control.
Despite the fact, one of the last time I looked, the socialists were either the major tendency in the European Union or one of the major tendencies. They're not acting in international solidarity?
I wouldn't think so, for a number of different reasons. Firstly, like I said, because they don't have any real power, and secondly, because the left is, in general, very confused about Europe. They're not quite sure if they want to, on the one hand, fight against this union of states which seems to be constructed as a Trojan horse for financial interest. On the other hand, there are laws within the European Union which basically sweeten the deal, which guarantee more labour laws than individual member states might necessarily give to workers themselves. So there's a great deal of confusion. I think that means that there's a lack of cohesion between different leftist groups involved in the European Parliament.
And obviously what happened in Greece, but Cyprus being more dramatic, is there fear in England that might have happened had they bought into the currency?
I think that's not really a fear so much as a consensus. People seem to think that the pound is very strong, and a lot of the austerity measures that have been advanced by the government have been specifically in order to protect the pound. On the one hand, those have been successful in protecting the pound, they just haven't really been particularly good for the people that use it.
Now, do people in England have any sense of George Soros getting rich by breaking the Bank of England in the old days?
People remember this. I can't remember the day of the week. It was Black Wednesday or Tuesday or Thursday. Who knows? But it was one particular day in the 1980s, I think. Although I was just a baby at the time. Yes, George Soros did very well thanks to the banking deregulation reforms and finance deregulation that took place wholesale under Margaret Thatcher.
And maybe you can speak about the Thatcher legacy here in the U.S. Reports of people singing Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead at the death of Lady Thatcher.
This is a very English kind of rebellion. There's actually a history to this as well. This happened one time before. There was basically, we have the Christmas number one every year, and we have various different other number ones where the song that makes the most money has to be played on national radio a certain number of times per day. This happened with the Christmas number one, I think, 3 years ago, when the X Factor winner was being pushed by Sony, and people decided to rebel against this because they didn't want to be patronised. So instead, everyone went and bought en masse Killing in the Name Of by Rage Against the Machine, and so that had to be played as the Christmas number one, and it was hilarious. Simon Cowell came out in public, and he was whining. He was just saying, everyone's being really mean to me, and it's a personal attack, and it's not fair. So the same thing happened after Margaret Thatcher died. There was an attempt by the establishment, by the Conservative government currently in power, to whitewash the history about Thatcher and try to claim that she was some sort of uniting figure, rather like after Reagan. He was sort of deified, you know, he was created into this figure that actually wasn't, you know, is apparently not divisive at all.
And Fox News was behind that in the US. Was Rupert involved at all? Mr. Murdoch there?
Mr. Murdoch is involved in almost everything these days. There was a huge phone hacking crisis, which I've actually written about in a separate article, referring to the British press and how compliant they are with the government. Rupert Murdoch's number one, previous number one in the UK, a woman called Rebecca Brooks, who was in charge of the entire British arm of News Corporation. She is the godmother of David Cameron's daughter. This is not a professional relationship. These people are friends. And so the idea of this whitewashing and this controlling of public opinion is very much a deliberate ploy by people who have known each other and have been friends for a very, very long time.
Is there a possibility Rupert Murdoch might go to jail? It seems if you're hacking the cell phones of 9/11 victims and just about everyone else of any note in the UK, it seems like there would be some repercussions.
There have been calls for this, but sadly it's very difficult to drum up public anger against someone that owns so many media outlets, because he can silence that anger, since it's not the public that write the headlines, it's Rupert Murdoch. That immediately gives him a huge amount of protection. He also, because he's hacked phones, probably has a lot of dirt on a lot of MPs, and so can say to them, do you want to make trouble for me? Because I can make trouble for you. So he's taken a big knock. His reputation is very much damaged. But he's still making plenty of money, and he's still got plenty of friends in high places.
And was that his third wife who divorced him?
I haven't really followed his marriage, to be honest, but I do understand it's fallen to bits lately.
I think the Asian woman.
Yeah. That's right. I've forgotten her name. Yeah, I don't really know what happened there. I'm kind of more interested in his power plays.
Well, his newspapers probably would... No, it's him, so they can't cover it. But anyway. So let's talk about the article on the so-called D-notice.
Okay, so a D-notice is something that has been happening in Britain. It's been a British government policy for about 100 years, which has been used several times.
Mm-hmm.
And it is essentially... It's a non-statutory request by the government to media outlets not to talk about a particular subject. So you cannot prosecute someone for violating a D-notice, but it's generally considered a polite warning. That
sort of a resolution of sentiment from the government as opposed to a law?
Pretty much, yes. And also it kind of tells... It's also rather a message of the government basically saying, are you my friend or... are you not? Because this may affect future decisions.
Well, why would the press care if they were the friends of the government? I mean, isn't their job to be a watchdog, not a lapdog?
Their job would be that, but like I said, there are so many private interests now which are both control the press and are very much in bed with the government. You've got the press dominated by a very small number of people, the names of which I know all of them, and many people do.
Who are they? Name them.
Okay, so you've got The Telegraph, which is actually a pretty decent paper. That belongs to the Barclay brothers, and that's a major kind of financial lobby. It's an old paper, it's very distinguished, and they do have very good journalists. So I don't have much beef with The Telegraph, except for their editorial stance, which is very much in support of tax evasion and derivatives traders who they refer to as talented. It's just quite offensive.
This is WCRS 98.3, 102.1 Community Radio. I'm Bob Fitragas. I'm talking to Lawrence Richards, the Free Press correspondent, who soon will be reporting from London.
I can't remember what I was talking about.
You told me about the Telegraph.
That's right, I told you about the Telegraph.
The name of who are the media powers in England.
So that belongs to the Barclay brothers. Then you've got Rupert Murdoch, obviously. He owns the Sun, he owns the Times. He previously owned the News of the World. That stopped and is now the Sun on Sunday.
And you mean the London Times?
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Which I always thought was, you know, the paper of record, like the New York Times here.
It formerly was. It's still respected as a newspaper, but it's no longer a broadsheet. He changed it to a compact format. And also because it belongs to Rupert Murdoch's empire, which is now discredited by large parts of British society, they're regarded with suspicion, if not outright distaste. Purely because of their financial association, but they seem to have a reasonable measure of editorial independence. The other papers belonging to Rupert Murdoch and the Sky News and Sky TV in general, which is a major television company in the UK. I think it's the second biggest after the BBC. Also has huge influence. Then you've got Lord Rothermere, who is an interesting character. Lord Rothermere, who is the son of Lord Rothermere, who is also the son of Lord Rothermere. They have owned the Mail Group for a long time. So that's the Daily Mail and the Mail on Sunday, and various other things aside. And it was the Rothermere family using using their influence over their holdings in the Daily Mail in previous times. Supported Hitler, they supported Oswald Mosley's black shirts, which were Britain's internal fascists in the 30s, and had a lot of praise for fairly misanthropic endeavours. They haven't much changed except for their style, which has gone even more gutter press than previously, and now they take on a very nasty stance towards homosexuals, take a very nasty stance towards immigrants. It frequently prints Islamophobic and racist op-eds. And they are also responsible for creating the political will which is supporting David Cameron's project of austerity, because they are helping to create horror stories about the welfare state to help deconstruct it.
So would have been fans of Margaret Thatcher, but to her right.
Huge fans of Margaret Thatcher. Many fans of Margaret Thatcher seem to have forgotten how unpopular she was just before she was forced out of office. But now, yes, it's now, oh, we miss Margaret. David Cameron is such a horrible liberal lefty. He's really so weak and he's so flimsy and doesn't represent the Conservatives at all. So they now actually seem to be warming towards UKIP, the UK Independence Party, which is essentially our Tea Party, recently polled at 25%. So quite a scary political force themselves.
Right, Hitler only got 3% in 1928, and in a free election never got more than 33%, so hopefully things won't go that far to the right. But,
thanks for that, Bob, that's very encouraging.
I always like to throw in a little history. Hitler, the Nazi Party only got 40% in the elections that they ran, which weren't considered fair, but 33%, those parliamentary systems. The largest party gets to form the coalition government.
Yes, indeed.
What about The Guardian? I mean, that's the one Americans really want to know. What is up with The Guardian?
So The Guardian, I want to say something special about The Guardian, not so much about their editorial stance, which I also agree with, but a question of ownership. I've just told you about all the newspapers belonging to a very small group of people who are in it to make a profit. The Guardian actually has its own trust. It's called the Scott Foundation, named after a former editor of theirs.
What's it called, the Scott?
The Scott Foundation.
Anything to do with Mary, Queen of Scots?
Not at all.
Good.
Scott with two T's.
you never know when there's a hellish, popish plot afoot.
Yes, indeed. Well, they don't have shareholders. They don't have outside interests. So they actually have control over their own purse strings. They have editorial sovereignty, which is very important. So the Guardian has been leading the story of Glenn Greenwald's attack on America's surveillance state. They've been the ones to print Snowden's revelations first every single time. And this is, I think, the biggest story that they've run in my lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of hard to imagine a bigger one.
Yes.
And again, is I think the United States is looking at two newspapers. Well, I suppose the Washington Post and the Guardian for criminal charges. So what makes, is it the trust fund that makes the Guardian so brave? The influence of the journalists, because there's no outside ownership group that could just shut them down?
I don't think that would be the sole cause. I think there's a certain amount of managerial character associated with that, and their editorial stance, which is very much about adversarial journalism. But also, yes, it is about the finance. It's about who owns it. Glenn Greenwald, for instance, before he joined The Guardian, was just a blogger and managed finances himself. When he went to work for The Guardian, he refused to be fully paid for by them. He wanted to be 50% supported by himself as well, in order to make sure that even they couldn't really touch his independence as a journalist, and they respected that.
So how is this playing out? Do you get any idea? You've been in the States here. Any idea how this is playing out politically in England?
Well, take, for example, what we were saying about the trade talks that are due to happen next week between Washington and the European Union. The European Union is in a terrible, terrible situation politically and economically, to the point where there is now not much demand for it to be kept together. It will not survive in its current state. It will either break apart in the next few years, or it will become a federal state in the next few years. It cannot survive in the state that it's currently in, is my assessment. And so that has been impacted by the news on surveillance, which not only says interesting things about sovereignty, about the fact that the European Union is already seen as a threat to sovereignty, but if someone is spying on them as well, then people really are going to start asking their governments, are you looking after me? And it will feed that fear of outside countries. The other side of that as well is that although many of these European countries are very upset about being spied on, they've said that we don't want to do trade talks. Perhaps without these trade talks, it doesn't really look very good for them. If the revenue isn't generated from the trade that would happen in this case, which would, I know, immediately bring more than £10 billion of trade to the UK. That's probably what, $16 billion or so, I guess. Then that could seriously speed up the economic decline of Europe. So we're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place.
This is Bob Petrakis, editor of thefreepress.org, talking with Free Press writer and soon to be heading the Free Press Bureau in England, Lawrence Richards. Lawrence, tell us about a D-notice. In fact, I had never heard of it. Even though I'm a journalist, I feel I should slap myself.
That's right. So the D-notice, as we said before, was a polite request by the government to not talk about certain things. It's been used numerous times, for instance, in times of war, where a government, this is back from the time of the British Empire, a government might say to newspapers, could you not talk about this particular thing that you know about until after the battle has been won? This has since been abused quite heavily. I'll tell you about the recent example in a moment, but I should also point out that in 2010, newspapers were served a D-notice by the government not to talk about WikiLeaks when that story was very fresh. And so
basically, I'm getting a feel like any major story that has real information, you shouldn't talk about. WikiLeaks, Snowden's revelations.
I mean, there have been lots of stories in between then that I would consider major as a British citizen, but yes, you're certainly...
But these are the most damning leaks. I mean, really, since probably Daniel Ellsberg shockingly released the Pentagon Papers and the Americans find out they'd been lied to systematically.
Yes.
From Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon, and they'd been lied to repeatedly about the war in Vietnam.
Yes, I would be interested actually to look up whether or not the story about Ellsberg was also treated with the D notice in the UK. I suspect not, because it wouldn't implicate the British state so much. But
is the British state issuing a D notice because they were involved and knew about the NSA spying?
Yes, GCHQ actually has been referred to by Edward Snowden as worse than the NSA, although we're yet to truly see what that's about. They have already spied on trade partners. For instance, in the 2009 G20 meetings, it was recently revealed by Snowden that many member states that visited the G20 meetings in London were being spied on, and that was the story which the D notice was served on, which newspapers were not allowed to talk about. There was one exception. The Guardian talked about it after a right-wing blogger broke the story, because he was disgruntled at the attempt to silence journalists. But apart from that, there was not a peep, and really, from The Guardian, it was just an op-ed kind of complaining about the fact that no one was talking about it.
Hmm. So it was just one story from Snowden that they were told not to write about?
One story that they were told not to write about through a D-notice, of which we're aware. Anything else, I think, would be speculation, although media collusion with the state, as I've already explained, is a systemic problem.
Well, let's talk about the People's Assembly. What was that story about?
Okay, so this also relates to the work that I'm going to be doing after I go back to the United Kingdom. Essentially, the British left was subject to a similar kind of betrayal as the American left with the Democrat Party. After Tony Blair came along and ruined the Labour Party as far as they were concerned. Where he essentially changed it from a party that wanted to redistribute the means of production that was actually in Clause 4 of their manifesto since 1920. Mm-hmm. He was the one that got rid of Clause 4 and instead tried to create a kind of social democratic state which was had basic safety nets but was largely constructed around financial interests.
And they changed their name to the Liberal Party then, right?
They did not, no.
Sounds like liberal politics, not Labour politics.
Broadly speaking, no, that's because we already have a Liberal Democrat Party, which is more or less the same, to be honest. They just spend a lot of time
pretending
to be
different. That was the right-wing break from the Labour Party, the Social Democrats and the Liberal Party?
That's right. It's quite a complicated history, but yes, the Social Democrats broke off from the Labour Party in the 1980s and then eventually joined with the Liberals to form the Liberal Democrats, who are now in government with the Conservatives. So it's a lot of parties,
uh-huh.
And we've actually been betrayed three times.
Decent right-of-centre coalition there. Well, at least they ended up with their logical projection.
Yeah.
And what about, I understood the Labour Party used to be a peace party before Blair.
It was a peace party,
particularly on illegal war. I mean, it's the Free Press's position that the attack on Iraq is a war crime, that it was not a preemptive strike. Iraq was not a threat to the U.S., and we believe anyone associated with it needs to be arrested and tried before the world.
I would completely agree, and at the time of the war being
which
declared,
which is why he's going to report from England. I complete agreement, just general principled agreement.
Yes, at the time of the war being declared, there were 2 million people as well who marched through London.
One of the biggest anti-war rallies in the world.
That was not just one of the biggest anti-war rallies in the world. It was the biggest protest in the streets in English history.
Uh-huh.
It was a very impressive thing, and so. The People's Assembly now has different priorities, but seems to harness a similar kind of energy. This is against austerity.
What is the People's Assembly?
The People's Assembly is a series of assemblies throughout numerous different cities across the UK to try and organise on a local and national level in a coordinated way against austerity, against the deconstruction of the welfare state, which is causing people already a lot of pain, and there's a lot more pain to come.
All right, looks like we're out of time there. Lawrence Richards, freepress.org. Any last thoughts on what you're going to write on when you're back in England?
Yep, there's a good season of civil disobedience coming up in the autumn, so hopefully I'm going to be there in the front lines, or maybe two lines back with a notepad.
All right, well, hopefully you'll have a gas mask as well.
Thank you.
Lawrence Richards, you can find his writings at the Free Press .org, and he'll be writing in the future from London or wherever else he finds himself in the UK. We also hope to establish reporters from Germany as well. This is Bob Petragas, The Other Side of the News, signing off.